Sorry, I just stuffed some Chex Mix in my mouth right before the intro. You think I'd know by now not to do that 20 seconds before I go on the air, but sometimes I still make that mistake. But I went with the Bold Mix, which is the best of the Chex Mix flavors. I think I'm the only one that buys it here at WGN out of the vending machine. It's all mine, and boy, it's tasty. Mike Leonard, save me, my friend. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, but I'm not really sure what is involved in the Bold Mix. I'm familiar with the old school mix, but not the Bold Mix.
I think more pepper. It's got more like pepper or garlic or onion flavor. It just, you know, it just bold. I don't know what to say. It's got bold flavors.
It's not a great explanation, John, but I'll take it. But I'm more of an old school guy. I think I like traditional versus bold, even though I've never had bold.
Well, I'll have to compare. Maybe we'll do this in the 2:30 if we're out of topics. I'll go get the other Chex Mix bag and look at the ingredients on the back because it has garlic powder. Boy, a bunch of other things I probably shouldn't be eating. Onion powder, dried Romano cheese. Ooh, that's good. And some other terrible ingredients. You're making me question all my choices, Mike, not going to lie.
Well, it's usually me that's wasting time talking about food, burgers, pizza. So I'm glad finally you have got the bug to talk about food.
For sure. How's everything going? How's work? You've been busy?
Yeah. We had a trial about a week ago, so I've had about a week off, and then we're starting a trial next week down in Springfield. So I've been preparing for that. So it's kind of like trial season from now until the end of the year.
It's busy. By the way, Wendy Snyder, who we all love and adore, texted me on my phone, says, "The bold is too bold for me." Come on, Wendy. Get with the time. You just got to get used to it. It's an acquired taste. Savory Bold Mix for Chex Mix. Underrated. And hello, Wendy. I love you. Okay, Mike. Sorry.
But, John, sometimes you don't interrupt a good thing. It's like taking original Pringles and making 40 flavors. Sometimes you just got to go with what works.
No, sour cream and onion are the best flavored Pringles. So original got an upgrade. You do need to mess with things because sometimes the original ends up being the most bland, boring flavor.
We'll see what the listeners have to say. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be a huge debate going on for the next hour for us.
The nice thing is I will only read the text messages that agree with me, and Mike can't see the text line. So there we go.
Yeah, that's pretty par for the course, buddy. I know how you operate.
312-981-7200. Yeah, Mike still is mad at me at how I forget which case you lost for the Christmas trials we've done, but you've always accused me of rigging the jury, so...
Well, lost in quotation marks. I clearly won. I think it was the last one.
It was Home Alone you lost, yeah.
You decided to be generous to our colleague that, hey, whoever votes guilty or not guilty next will be the winner for Mike or Patrick. And, of course, I lost because of that rigged system. I'm so angry.
Yeah, that's okay. I can tell. All right, so you've been busy. You're going to be busy here for the next couple of months. But I appreciate you still hopping on with us here on WGN. You sent a story along that is an interesting one, the idea of age verification or age limits to social media and how that's played out in Mississippi. And perhaps this could lead to other states either taking it up or not. Dive into this one for us. Give us the details.
Yeah, well, the cool thing is, even though it's a Mississippi state law, it's going to apply. I mean, some version of this is going to get decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, which I think is great. But in more specifics here, Mississippi passed the law to deal with this issue of our ever-growing concern about social media and its effect upon minors, and passed this law in 2024 that said basically three things. Number one, that you have to age verify, you know, for these different platforms. And the platforms include things like Facebook, Instagram, things of that nature. It actually defines what it applies to as the types of things where you make connections with others, where you're able to post, all those sorts of things. So it's very broad ranging. But what it seeks to legislate is, number one, age verification, like legitimate age verification.
Not just like enter your birth date?
Correct. Number two, parental consent, which is a big issue, right? You have to actually have actual parental consent to be a part of these, you know, be a part of these social medias. And then three, which is probably the way that the law is going to get struck down, it affirmatively requires these social media companies to take affirmative steps to limit what they call harmful material to minors. Okay, that's where I think the law will eventually get sunk and has to be redefined. But what happened was, of course, immediately all these social media companies went to the federal court in Mississippi, and the federal court said, okay, no, this law is unconstitutional. You're probably going to win. Social media companies, I'll enjoin it, meaning the law does not go into effect. Immediately, that was appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal appeals court that covers Mississippi and or several other states. And they rejected that. They vacated the injunction, said, okay, the law can be enforced. And so immediately they went to the United States Supreme Court, which has refused to take the case on, which is very interesting. So they didn't rule either way. And the strange thing is that they did have one Justice Kavanaugh made the statement that I think likely you social media companies will win because this is likely unconstitutional, but you don't meet the very high standard to get emergency relief from the U.S. Supreme Court. So what that means is this law can go in effect, is in effect right now, at least in Mississippi. And, of course, there's a bunch of other laws that are similar, not quite as broad, that require age verification. So I think this is a really hot topic that I think in 2 years, 5 years, there'll be laws all over the country about these types of issues, which I personally think is a very good thing.
Isn't social media a free speech issue?
Yeah, that's the whole problem. So that's the whole legal issue, which will be decided. You know, the court's going to have to decide to what degree can you limit the rights of minors to have free speech, right? And, you know, how important are these other considerations that people are arguing are having such a horrible effect upon young people? How can we protect them, and what degree, and how much free speech is allowed, and how much can we protect? So that's going to be the big battleground. But I would be shocked if we're having conversation in the next 3 to 5 years where there's not some pretty hefty laws in place that are dealing with this. I don't think this particular law will probably be upheld, but I think there's going to be things like this, and I think it's a good thing, personally.
Interesting. I don't know where I stand on this. I think I was trying to, like, rack my brain on things that we don't let minors do or purchase or be a part of in the marketplace of ideas. Like, you can't limit, I imagine, a kid from buying a newspaper and being part of that marketplace of ideas. But there have been, obviously, age restrictions on purchasing pornography. Of course, that's all different these days, how it's disseminated. But I'm sure there's been laws in the past that have been upheld. I don't know if all the way to the Supreme Court on that regard, where they do deem that, nope, that is speech that is should be and in the public's best interest to be protected or to protect minors from that. So that'll be an interesting discussion when it happens, because in this day and age, social media is how a lot of teenagers communicate with each other through the apps. It's how they express their ideas, their political ideas, their thoughts on religion, their thoughts on everything. And to restrict that from minors would, to me, seem to be an overreach and would seem to strip them of their vital First Amendment protections, Mike.
Well, it's a tough one. I mean, number one, we do have a little bit of precedent to go by. We do know that the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld age restrictions on pornography sites. So that's already happened. So that gives you a clue that maybe under the right circumstances, they're going to find particular laws if they're narrow enough to be constitutional, right? But I think, you know, you're missing a lot because, you know, nowadays, and your son is too young, but literally nowadays you have kids who are 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 who have social media accounts, who have cell phones, who are on these sites on a daily basis for hours at a time. And so I look at it very differently. My kids are now all, you know, my youngest is 19 and some are older, but in a way, they avoided some of that,
yeah.
but not really. And so there clearly is a substantial need to do something about this problem.
Well, here's the thing. I completely get the harms that it causes. Body image, right? The idea that people live these fantastic fake lives on Instagram, people scroll through videos, influencers trying to sell kids makeup, trying to sell them the looks, the addiction that kids have to social media, the way it frames their thoughts, the way it changes their behaviors, the bullying, all of that is, of course, can be a huge harm to kids. I think that that's a universal fact, can be a huge harm to kids. But why is it on the company? Well, I don't know where I don't know, Mike. Like, I feel like parents need to play the role here, not the government.
Yeah, but it's so ubiquitous. It's so easy to be on. I mean, all you need to do, you don't even have to have a phone. You just have access to a computer. You can be any age, and you can have access to some of the most horrible things or some of the most horrible pressures. I mean, if we understand that it really is a legitimate social problem, which it seems to be, why can't we do something that addresses it, even if it might infringe upon First Amendment rights of a minor? I think the problem is so great that it merits something like that. I mean, obviously it needs to be more narrowly tailored, but, you know, the parents don't even necessarily know what the kid's doing. It's not necessarily because the kids don't, because the parents don't care or don't try. It's almost impossible to monitor what they have access to, even if you have an iPad from school or whatever. I mean, so it's basically saying, look, the kid's got to get the parents' consent. I don't have a problem with that. And then, you know, you got to verify that the age is really the age they say. I don't think that is onerous.
That's fair.
I did see a very interesting argument to the contrary, because one of the interesting arguments to the contrary was people who are, say, in the high school era in that age group, and they might not be able to connect with people who are having similar issues or problems with them,
right?
Or are in a minority in a certain issue. And this is a way, you know, using social media, they can interact with people that are facing some of the same problems they do. So that's sort of the counter to it. But to me, it's an enormous problem that there has to be ways. We can't just give up and say it's impossible. You can't limit free speech, you know, to minors. You know, we can't address it at all. I just don't think that's legit.
That's a fair point. We're not saying that no one under the age of 18 can or can't have social media. The app is, or the law is, saying that parents have to give consent. I think that there's a middle ground here, Mike. And I think that part of it is maybe that line in the sand of 18, maybe we don't use that for this. Maybe instead of just dividing minors and adults by that arbitrary line at 18, like you mentioned, high school students, maybe it's 15, right? Where we avoid maybe the first couple of years where those formative 8, 9, 10-year-olds, like you're saying, truly their brain is different than a 15-year-old, which I'm saying not a 15-year-old is not fully developed. I'm just saying it is a little bit more advanced. So maybe what ends up happening is a line that's drawn not based on the arbitrary 18, but of a perhaps a different age.
Yeah, and it's kind of one of these very broad issues. So, for example, if a parent said, yeah, I think my kid's old enough to have a Facebook account or an Instagram account, and they sign off on that, that's good in a way, but it really doesn't do anything, because then what you have access to is incredible, right? So a parent may still think, oh, that's great, I'm age verifying, I think they're now at the age where they can have access to this stuff. But what they're not probably understanding in some instances, or a lot of instances, that what that gives you access to or subjects you to. So I don't know, I think it's going to be a great issue. I think we should have this discussion in 5 years when you're still hosting Let's Get Legal, and we'll save this audio, and we'll revisit it, okay?
I'm not done with this, Mike, because now I'm thinking, what if you got like a 14-year-old, and you've got two parents who are deeply one religion, and they are preaching that, and they are so fearful that their kid will find another religion or something or a different lifestyle they want to lead, and that social media connection is, you know, educating them on the other differences that people have in the world, and a whole different world of possibilities, that by restricting or requiring that threshold to go through those parents who are restricting the speech of a minor who desperately wants to have access to it, like, that would be an example where there should be, that would be overreach, right?
Yeah, well, that's the whole issue. Like, how do we decide, like, in a particular state, or from a federal standpoint, how do you decide what age that is? I mean, you can debate that forever. And it also is dependent upon the kid in some ways, right? But sometimes it's not, because you think the kid is old enough, so to speak, but you're allowing them access to all sorts of stuff that you really wouldn't want to have access to, even though you think in certain ways they're mature and can handle a social media account of some time. So that's why I think it's going to be real tough to come up with a law that's constitutional, but I think this particular Supreme Court is going to do that eventually, because I think they're obviously conservative. They obviously see this as a societal problem. But yeah, you can debate this one all day long.
Yeah, but if you were to ask the framers, this is a very originalist court, Mike, which we've talked about for other issues. And I would argue that perhaps the Supreme Court will hold true to the First Amendment, which has a broad reach. And the burden would be on the government to prove why this is so necessary. And yeah, maybe the example I gave of the 14-year-old who wants to see other religions are the vast minority of people using social media for those means, or for the person who needs to connect with other people that is having a similar identity crisis or a different sexual identity that they only find community with online. That is probably the lesser example than the broad use of social media. But guess what? The burden's on the government to prove why they should be able to restrict speech. And I don't think you've met that burden, Mike Leonard.
I don't know that I have. I just think it's a great issue. I think that it's one that needs to be talked about more. I think we all agree. I mean, parents and non-parents, as a parent of four kids, I've seen, you know,
it's a mess.
They came a little bit later than how it is now.
Yeah, but I got still, Mike.
Still,
I got to hit.
It's still pretty bad.
I got to hit the break. I just love arguing with you, which is why I did it. So
I know.
It's federal defense attorney Mike Leonard, 312-91-7200. Phone lines open. Get your questions in. WGN federal defense attorney Mike Leonard here on the line. Hey, Mike, we're going to talk about Mike Madigan in a second. You mind if I take one quick call here for you, buddy?
Love it, buddy.
Well, it's really for both of us and for our news person, Mr. Snowden. Hello. Welcome to WGN.
Good afternoon.
You are Sylvia's proud father, I bet.
Oh, extremely proud.
Oh, Sylvia, we got your dad on the line.
Oh, Dad. Oh, my gosh.
You're a lawyer,
hi,
right?
Hi, Dad.
Indeed, I am.
And you listen to, obviously, Sylvia, and then in between Sylvia's reports, you just happen to have to listen to my show, right?
Well, somebody's got to listen.
I like so you,
well,
Charles.
No, I enjoy the show.
Yeah, good.
I enjoy the show.
What kind of law do you do?
I'm a journalist.
Okay.
I do all kind of stuff, civil and criminal.
Oh, that's interesting. Have you ever crossed paths with Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney?
I don't think I have.
why isn't Sylvia a lawyer? Did you try and make her do that pathway?
Yes, I did. She said she didn't want to work like that. So.
Work as hard as that? She works hard.
I know she works hard, but she's good at what she does.
Yeah, she
thank you. She'd be bored with what I do.
Sylvia, is that true?
I'm a very competitive person, and I'm the sort of person who takes losing personally. My father knows that that's just my personality, and so I didn't think a career in law was for me because, I mean, I can't get used to the idea of losing.
Well, then don't lose, Sylvia. Get back to law school and never lose a case, and then it's solved.
There you go. Simple as that.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Charles, anything else you want to say? Go ahead.
I was going to say, funny, Sylvia, that's why I love, this is Mike, love the law, because I love the fact that it's competitive. I think that's why I like it so much.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Dad, go ahead.
Go ahead, Charles.
Well, it is very competitive. But at the same time, you have to understand you win some and you lose some. But on the subject you were talking about, you know, children are not little adults. And they don't have all the rights that adults have. We've all been in school. You know that the police can't come to your home and say, okay, we're getting ready to have a search of your home. Would you please vacate so that we can perform that search? But they can have, for example, locker searches in schools.
Hmm.
They come in and they can tell you to open your locker, and they will act as in loco parentis or as a parent. Hmm. And they'll come in and they'll search your locker, and if there's something found that's not there, you can't go in and suppress the evidence or anything like that like you could in a case.
So you're saying that my contention that just because they're underage, they are still have full access to all the rights of the First Amendment, you find that argument to be flawed?
Oh, it is. It is. And it's unfortunate. You know, if you're under the age of 18, but that's kind of the way this world works.
Yeah.
Also, you've got Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which shields social media companies from things that are posted. Who are you going to go after?
Yeah.
So it's a morass.
Sylvia, you didn't tell me your dad was going to school me here on my show. Well, I don't know if I would have taken the call. So
we need him out here more often. Anyone who calls up John Hansen on a regular basis and tells him he's wrong, we want more of that.
That my dad has never been afraid to let you know.
I like it. No, it's a good. Actually, it's a great point because I was kind of thinking that in my head of, you know, what, you know, that we obviously have limits of voting, right? There are different things in the Constitution that allocate age differently and don't apply equally to all. And that is an interesting argument of how far not only the First Amendment, but the other amendments apply to children or not. And boy, that's an interesting discussion. And Charles schooled me on it. I love that. Charles, any other thoughts you have for Sylvia or for our audience before we let you go?
Well, just one more. When you're talking about trying to find a new religion, mm-hmm. you'd be pitting two sections of the Constitution against one another because you've got freedom of speech and you've got freedom of religion. Who wins out?
I don't know. I mean, they're in the same amendment, too. They're all looped together.
Right. So...
Yeah,
it's a mess.
So you're saying I do have an interesting argument there that perhaps it is a restriction of the freedom of religion or some other aspect that could bolster my case, or am I reading too much?
It could very well be.
Oh,
it could very well be.
He's giving me a little nugget of hope. I love that, Charles. I got to get back to Mike, though, but thanks for calling in. We love
thanks,
Sylvia.
Thanks, Dad.
All right. Okay. All right. See you later, Sylvia.
Bye.
All right. Bye now. Bye.
Oh, your dad's so nice.
Isn't he the best?
Smart guy, no surprise.
Love you, Dad.
Oh, that's sweet. Thanks, Sylvia. Mike Leonard, I got schooled there a little bit. Why didn't you bring that up when I was talking with you?
Well, it seems like to me, for all these years, you've been censuring the people who disagree with you. You know, a guy like that can never get on the air because you see what he texts like, oh, no, next caller, please.
You're right. So he used a smoke screen of being the dad of the news person to get on in.
I think the fantastic point is, I agree with them 100%. I personally have no problems with people who are age 6 to 18 having more limited First Amendment rights than an adult. They're not adults, and the stuff they're have access to and are subjected to on social media to me is absurd. And to try to limit that, I have no problem with it, whether it violates the First Amendment or not, because I don't think it does. But I think when you're that age, you don't have the same rights.
Mm. You're probably right. I'll try and come up with a better argument for it. But you want to talk about Mike Madigan, too, so let's make sure we get to that. Give us the setup for a ruling that came down this week.
Yeah, real brief. So what happened was, I think Madigan's counsel was, of course, very optimistic about the idea of getting bond or getting his reporting to prison stayed while his case is being heard by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. So, you know, it's very rare that the appellate court intervenes and says, yes, you have a case that's on appeal, so therefore we're going to stay the reporting of you to serve your sentence. That happens very rarely. You basically have to make a showing to the appellate court that you really have a substantial likelihood of winning your appeal, so you know, which is hard to do, you know, to kind of prejudge how they're going to rule. So they filed that with the district court in Chicago, and I think they had obviously had a lot of optimism that based upon how the law applies to this whole thing we've been talking about for the last couple of years about what's a quid pro quo, what's a gratuity, that the appellate court might say, hey, Mr. Madigan, we think you have a great chance of winning your appeal. Therefore, we're going to stay your reporting to prison. The district court denied that. So, which to me wasn't a big surprise because, of course, the district court would have to believe that they were wrong. And therefore, you know, they would say that you should be stayed. So, it looks likely that he will remain having to serve his sentence while the case is on appeal, but we'll see. We'll see what the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has to say about that.
October 13th, he has to report to prison. More than 7 years behind bars was the sentence. And, Mike, you said this before, but just repeat for people that think, he's just going to serve a year or two and get out. That's not how it works with federal sentencing.
No, typically it's 85% of the sentence. So if you got a five-year sentence, you would know that you would serve at least 85%, but then you get a reduction. Most people these days are getting at least a year off of that. So 85 or whatever your number is, minus probably a year, and sometimes a little bit more. And there are opportunities now to get out earlier than that. But yeah, he will serve a significant period of time. Whether it's enough for some people is an open question. But yeah, it's 85% minus any time you serve, plus probably a year off of that.
Okay. Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney. We still got one more segment. 312-91-7200. We'll open it up to anything and everything as another jet roars on by on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney here. Mike, I have a question for you, and sorry I didn't prep you for this one. I figure you'll have a response, though. I don't know if you heard the story about the Aaron Water show yesterday, where during the rehearsal, the Jets, I don't know what happened. Some people say it was a sonic boom. Others say, no, that's not possible with the Thunderbirds. But either way, a series of apartment buildings and apartments had damage to them as the Jets were flying by, presumably done by sound, as nothing physically hit these buildings. Steve Dale, one of our co-hosts here on the WGN, or one of my colleagues, he mentioned to me yesterday that, yeah, like, thing rattled things out of the cupboards. It broke glass. And I thought, well, those people are due compensation for this. But it's essentially the Army, Navy, and putting on this show, the federal government. It's hard to sue the federal government, Mike. How would something like that work? Any idea?
Well, there's a couple issues. Yes, there would be, number one, were they negligent? You know, did they exercise reasonable care? Which would be a question of, you know, how close did they get to these structures, right? And how foreseeable was it that, you know, getting close to that structure would result in a damage to property? But before you even got to that, whether they were negligent, you'd have to decide whether there's immunity. You know,
right.
Can they be sued? Which I don't know the answer, and that's probably why you wanted to stump me. However,
I didn't want to stump you. I just was because I know the I know the federal government has sovereign immunity, but there are ways in which they do allow lawsuits against them.
Yeah, I would think something like this that they wouldn't be immune from suit. But I'll bet this has happened in some other city before, and so there's probably an answer out there. However, don't forget about the other possible defendant. So, you know, the city or whoever organizes this event allows them to do certain things. So there's certainly also an argument that if it's the city of Chicago who's approving this, who's setting the parameters of where they can fly and how close they can fly and what they can do, that they're negligent because they should have foreseen that flying this close would result in property damage. So that's a potential another defendant to the case.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to overreact to it, and hopefully the city comes forward and says, yeah, we'll cover the bills of the broken glass or whatever it is, or whoever will ultimately pay for this.
How extensive was it, and how close to downtown were the structures?
It was along Lakeshore Drive, up near Belmont, Addison, Irving Park. There were reports of a few buildings. So I don't know if it was a single jet or the repetitive nature of all the jets and where they went that caused the damage, or whether they did hit Mach 1, although some people have said on the text line, Thunderbirds can't hit Mach 1 during this sort of the way they have like governors on their planes essentially during these sorts of performances that would limit that. Well, either way, it was close enough and extensive enough over a wider swath of area that a lot of homeowners are experiencing some damages, Mike.
I'm surprised that has never happened before in Chicago.
Well, maybe it has. Maybe it has, and we haven't reported. Yeah. I don't know.
I used to love when our office, I used to work for a firm who had offices in the Sears Tower, and it was pre-9/11. They used to let them get super close. I mean, it was like you could literally see a person in the cockpit. And it was amazing and close. I don't think they let them get as close plus 9/11 as they used to.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I love it. I think the show is great. I hope they keep it, and I think they will. It's just that maybe this is something that does need to be revisited. I imagine it's going to be a story as they try and figure out, well, that was too close for comfort. Let's make sure this doesn't happen again, or God forbid, something worse.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the scariest thing too is that you always worry about there being an accident or a crash, because it seems like what they do is so spectacular.
And there are air shows that experience that. Well, I actually think now I'm jinxing. We shouldn't. Let's get through this weekend. And I'm just superstitious on that start.
Do we have time for me to say why I'm still a little bit bitter at the Blue Angels, or should I not talk about that today?
You're bitter at the Blue Angels?
Yeah, because we were in San Francisco 1 year. I was with my daughter, who at the time was like 10. And I didn't know they did Blue Angel shows there too, which was really cool because you were pretty close. You were basically, you know, you were seated by the water, kind of near the Golden Gate Bridge. And so it just happened that they were staying at the same hotel we were. And so we encounter them with my daughter, who's like just fascinated by this. They're wearing these cool outfits, right? And so, you know, I kind of try to make conversation with them and say, hey, my daughter, so excited to see you guys. They could have cared less. It was so weird. I thought they were going to be super nice to her and say, thank you, kid, and all that literally no interest. It was I'm still a little bitter, John.
Maybe they had a tough day, Mike. Let's not come
maybe
on. Don't,
so.
Let,
maybe
let,
so.
Let go of that. Like, what happens if you get a? You're sure you're going to win a case. You argued it so well, and then you get a guilty verdict for your client that you know is innocent. And you're at the bar later, and some little kid wants to hit your autograph. I want to be a federal defense attorney one day. You know, are you going to turn around and be the most joyful guy ever?
John, if anyone ever asks my autograph, I will be so overwhelmingly happy that you wouldn't imagine. I would buy the kid Diet Coke and orange drinks the whole night.
Yeah, I'm sure. 6-0 says, why do you jump to suing? If no one was hurt and they pay for the damages, everyone doesn't need to sue. Yeah, I'm saying if they pay for the damages, we're good. That's what I'm saying. I was just creating a hypothetical 6-3-0. Okay. I shouldn't get so offended by the text.
It wouldn't be surprising if someone sued, though, but hopefully the damage was, you know, nominal for everyone that the city or someone can just cover that.
I think that's ultimately what will happen. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. As it should. I agree. Like, you don't need to be overly litigious. Okay, Mike, we got a text question wondering, do defense attorneys literally Google jurors as they're doing the process of jury instruction or jury figuring out who's on the jury?
Yes. Yes and no. So weirdly enough, even in federal court in Chicago, so I recently had the thing about a year or two ago where the court said we could not do that during jury selection, which I thought was weird because it was just trying to find publicly available information that's already out there. So I thought, like, what is the harm? If there's no privacy interest, if you're putting stuff out there about yourself or there's stuff publicly available, why would that be a problem? So I thought that was unusual. I had not had that happen occur before. But then my recent cases, I've had no restrictions on the ability to do that. The problem is it's hard to do it that quickly. You know, if you have a couple paralegals with you, you have to literally, you'd have to convey the names to them as you're sitting there and have them look stuff up and they get feedback. It's hard to do on the fly like that. But if you're given enough time, I think it's a great idea. But like everything else, it's just one more piece of the puzzle. But since in federal court, especially where your right to ask questions of jurors with some judges is extremely limited, if you can get any other information, I'm all for it, and I'd love to do it. It's just sometimes hard practically to pay attention to what the jurors are saying during selection and to be able to do that at the same time and get meaningful value out of what you're finding online.
So you don't get a list like hours ahead of time. It's literally as they're being questioned, they say their name.
Yeah, well, some courts and some jurisdictions, you sometimes do get it a little bit in advance. In federal court in Chicago, you get the juror questionnaires that day, that morning. So let's say we're going to have jury selection at 10. We're getting the questionnaires at like 9:30. And so it just has kind of say there's 20 questions on there, but they're kind of, a lot of them are name, rank, serial questions, like your name, where do you live, do you have a spouse, you know, what's your job? And then a lot of generic questions about, have you been involved in litigation before? Have you served on a jury? So the questions themselves on the questionnaires are not real insightful, but sometimes something obviously jumps out at you. Like, for instance, you have a defense lawyer and someone says, all my relatives are Chicago police officers or they all work for the FBI. I want to know more about that. But you get the questionnaires, you get that information, and then all of a sudden you're already in the process beginning at 10 with, you know, the judge and then you, to some extent, are asking them questions. So you don't have a lot of time to have this great cushion to do a lot of research before the jury selection starts.
I know you obviously want that information. You're looking for any competitive advantage you can get over the prosecutors in any way possible. And I go back and forth on that. I think part of me, I'm like, nah, you shouldn't be able to Google. Just ask the questions. But if you have a defendant who, let's say, is black, and you can find a juror that has racist sentiments on their social media pages, I don't want that juror on that jury, and I don't think anyone should. That's not a fair, unbiased juror. So that would be an example where I'm like, yeah, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah, what would be, I mean, I guess people would have just a knee-jerk reaction, maybe saying, you shouldn't know information about me that I don't want you to know, but if you're putting out there for public consumption anyways, I don't see that as a valid argument.
You're offering it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, if the idea is let's get the best, most fair and impartial jury we can, anything that's relevant to that, I think that supports the process, why not? Why would you want to limit people artificially to figuring out, you know, what the people are really like, what they're really thinking, what they're really doing, you know? Yeah.
I got to go, Mike. What number can people reach you at if they need any of your services?
Good to see you, buddy. Good to hear from you. 312-380-6559. Leonard Trial Lawyers.
Mike, always is a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, John.